With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
You don't think that it's time that somebody cared enough to have a dream?
Why are you getting so upset? This is not about you.
Yes, it is. You are a human affront to all women, and I am a woman.
At some point, you gotta decide for yourself who you are. Can't let nobody make that decision for you.
How do you go about getting an exorcism?
I beg your pardon?
Hi, this is Mark Kermode. Thanks for downloading this Kermode on Film podcast. And this week we have a real treat for you. If you were watching the MK3D online show that went up on the BFI's YouTube channel about a week ago, you'll know that one of the guests on that show was the great Andy Serkis. Now, obviously, on the BFI YouTube channel, the show is only around an hour long. We have several guests, so we have to cut those interviews down. However, here on Kermode on Film, we're able to enjoy longer versions of those interviews. So last week, we heard from Monica Dolan and Simon Bird about their new film Days of the Bagnall Summer, and we heard from the great Jason Isaacs. This week we were able to sit back and spend some quality time with the one and only Andy Serkis. So Andy, welcome to the show, albeit virtually. How the hell are you?
Well, that's a big question, isn't it? Because it's a very surreal situation, and you know, being at home with the family is locked away from everything has its benefits. It's very nice to see everybody and spend time with them. Obviously, when you look out into the far world, you know, the world beyond, and see what everybody's going through and the suffering that people are going through, and the misery and the distress and all of that. So I've sort of flipped between those two worlds, really, I suppose, on a constant moment to moment basis. Both feeling lucky that I'm sort of safe, touch wood, indoors, and with the family, and just, you know, yeah, just kind of concerned about people people getting through this.
I don't know where you live. Where are you?
I'm in Oxfordshire. So we've been holed up in a barn basically for the duration. I've also been editing. So I've been going into work, and I've been lucky enough to continue working on Venom as well. So you know, that's been a blessing, really. We just wrapped on Venom 2 just as everything was going into lockdown. So my editor then had to move to the States, and back to the States where he lives, and we've been doing it remotely. So that's what I've been doing.
So what can you tell us, if anything, about Venom? What can we expect?
Oh, I can't, you know, I mean, the studio police will be down on me like I've already been told off a number of times, but it's been delayed, obviously. It's coming out next June now, which is exciting because it's a really great date. It's, you know, bang in the middle of June. So it's going to be, it'll have a summer opening, but also we've got more time to work on it. It was always going to be a rush to get it made in time. But it's very exciting. And I really had a wonderful shoot. I can't tell you too much more. Time. There's so long to go with.
Okay. And I imagine that exactly the same answer applies to Batman then.
Exactly the same answer, even more so. I have to be, because I've already been, you know, castigated for opening my mouth inappropriately.
I don't want you to tell me anything that you shouldn't tell me, but have you ever been told off for saying more than it? Because I know it must be really, really difficult. I remember really clearly Simon Mayo interviewing Cillian Murphy. I think it was when Inception was out, and he was asking him a question about the next Chris Nolan. And Cillian said, I can't say anything about it. And then Simon said, well, just tell us whether you're in it. And Cillian Murphy said, I can't tell you even that. And Simon said, why not? And he said, because I've signed a piece of paper, which Simon said, which means you're in it, because you wouldn't possibly have signed it. But it must be really strange, because the length of time ahead that you work on these kind of things, at any one time, the thing that you're talking about cannot be the thing that you are working on in always, that moment.
Always. I mean, that's just the way it is. You know, you're constantly kind of thinking back to that, the moment, trying to relive moments that were a year and a half ago, often on these on the film, certainly, that I've been working on in the recent past. You know, so it is very strange, because obviously people assume that it's a current thing and they're plugged into it, as they should be, and very excited about it coming out. But like you say, often it's such a long period of time since you were going through it. But I know it is, and your mind is focused on the job in hand, and at the same time you're sort of dredging up all of the things that you know, which is also part of the job, of course, in this world.
But you did very recently. I mean, this is in the very recent past. The Hobbit, the Hobbit-a-thon, which must be fresh. And so describe that for me. What was it like?
It was, you know, so it was exactly a week ago today, actually, and it was really intense. Deep dive into, I've never done, I've done audiobooks before, but it's a completely different thing. You can stop, you can go back, you can edit, you can, you know, you can fluff stuff, which I did when I was doing the Hobbiton, by the way. But on this, it was like a live, you know, I wanted to give it like a live performance feel. And so I play, you know, I did voices for all the characters and all the rest of it, but it was incredible. I think I had 4 2-minute or 3-minute breaks in 11 hours, and the rest of it was just kind of reading it. And I kind of went for it, because I chose that because, you know, talking about being able to get out, and if you like being out in nature, you know, there is no greater story in a way for going off on an adventure and experiencing Middle Earth and an extraordinary world, and feeling, you know, I love, as you know, I'm a mountaineer and a climber, and I love the outside. I love outdoor world. And I just really, really feel for people who are trapped in an apartment or a block, or that, you know, they literally can't even open a window or get out onto a balcony. So I wanted to take people on an adventure. And I thought, well, this would be, you know, not quite Captain Tom going around the garden on his frame, but the idea of going on a journey with everybody, if they wanted to join in and do it all in one hit. And also I did it for the NHS and for Best Beginnings, which is a charity that I'm an ambassador for.
Chapter 5, Riddles in the Dark. When Bilbo opened his eyes, he wondered if he had, for it was just as dark as with them shut. No one was anywhere near him. He just imagined his fright. He could hear nothing. He could see nothing. He could feel nothing except the stone of the floor. Very slowly he got up and he groped about on all fours till he touched the wall of the tunnel, but neither up nor down could he find anything. Nothing. Nothing at all. No signs of goblins, no signs of dwarves. His head was swimming, and he was far from certain even of the direction that they had been going when he had his fall.
I really enjoyed it. I really screwed up quite a lot of it, and I really lost my mind about halfway through when I didn't know. I was reading pages that I didn't remember reading when I got through it. I'm like, the whole chunks of it I don't even remember doing. It was quite an extraordinary thing.
So did you rehearse for it at all, or did you? It was literally you were coming. I mean, obviously you read it before. But did you rehearse like the day before, or did you go through?
I did chunks of reading, like training for a marathon. You know, I sort of read 20 pages, 30 pages out loud, 40 pages out loud in the lead up to it, just to, you know, get the lips, the teeth, the tip of the tongue. You know, get all that going. And get back into it, because of course I did. I mean, I read it as a kid, and I read it obviously when we were working on the movies, but not for a while. So and there are chunks in it where I literally started off thinking it was Gandalf speaking, and then it was Thorin, and so I had to change character mid paragraph, and you know, all of those things. And because at the end it says said Gandalf, you know, and it's just like I think it's Thorin.
But it's funny because
it depends.
I've done audio, but every book that I've written, I've done the audio book of, and it's always taken, you know, six separate recording days, because they say, you know, you do a couple of hours. I go, oh, it's easy. I mean, I just, how hard can it be? I'll read 6 hours. And of course, as you say, you go back, you do retakes and everything, but also you just get, I mean, this sounds so pathetic when people are actually out doing jobs that involve building houses and, you know, you go, but reading stuff out loud's really tiring. It's really surprising, isn't it?
Concentration. It's concentration, isn't it? It just blows after a while. That's the thing.
Are you managing to play any music whilst all this is happening?
Do you know, I haven't. I'm sure you've been able to, though, haven't you? Because I know I really wanted to join you on your show, and I was really sorry not to do that. And it just was impossible. It would just happen to be an impossible time, you know, with Venom, actually, with you know that Venom movie got in the way of us getting together. but I'm sorry. Yes. I've not had much of a chance. Although I'd love to.
Well, listen. I want you to come on the live show when all this is through, and whenever that is, and you know, I want you to come on the live show, and I want you to play with us, because we've had loads and loads of, you know, musical guests, which has been lovely, and you know, David Arnold and Neil Brand and everything. But I want you on the show playing with us. One of the things that I'm kind of interested in for everybody is, have you been listening to music? Has there been a piece of music that's got you through this? Is there something that you use as a comfort record? Because I have been playing over and over again, this is so cheesy, but the Mark Knopfler soundtrack to Local Hero, which I could just put on and it just takes me away. Is there any music that you've been listening to?
I've been listening to John Coltrane's A Love Supreme. Actually, it's such an amazing kind of. I mean, as you know, I'm a bit of a jazzer, and I play tenor sax, and he's always been my hero. So, I just find that so. It just transports you into another. It's like going on a journey with it every single time. So that's definitely been a lot of that, to much to the rest of my household's dismay. So.
Now, I may have told you in advance that I wanted you to choose a couple of films, both a guilty pleasure and a film that changed your life. Which one do you want to go for first?
The guilty pleasure, I think, which is actually, This Is the End. Seth Rogen, James Franco, Danny McBride, Jonah Hill. All my, you know, all those guys trapped in, you know, in an apocalypse. But I just keep, it cheers me up constantly, because it's so, and I actually got to know Seth. I actually got to know Seth as he was making that film. We had a few meetings, and he showed me stuff before it actually came out. And I laughed my socks off then, but it constantly makes me howl with laughter. I mean, literally weep with laughter. And my family have seen it a lot too. And the performances are so great and so, and because they're playing versions of themselves, it's very, you know, it's just wonderfully, it's just wonderfully fresh and brilliant. And, but it's also about friendship, and it was also, you know, it's about their relationships for real. So it has that double-edged thing, which really keeps me entertained. So I do watch, you know, it's a relatively modern movie, but I would say that is probably my greatest guilty pleasure if I'm feeling like I need cheering up in any way.
You actually not know what happened last night?
Daniel, you may want to stay seated for a second. Some really messed up stuff happened, and there were a lot of fatalities.
Oh, really? You're putting your serious voice on, Jonah? Okay, tell me about these fatalities.
Dude, Siegel's dead. Krumholz is dead. Michael Cera's dead.
Yes, so Michael Cera's gone. It's not a total loss, huh?
Jesus, Danny.
Michael Cera's dead.
It's not like that.
It's not funny, man.
It's really not funny.
Seth, that's a better performance than you've given in your last six movies. Where the fuck was that in Green Hornet, huh? Jonah, you're fucking sucking balls. You're an Academy Award nominated person. You need to be fucking selling that shit, dude. Fatalities. There was some fatalities.
Fatalities.
Okay, now that was good.
When you say they play versions of themselves, I think one of the things about that movie that is really interesting is that there's a couple of characters who are playing versions of themselves, and it's the closeness to what you imagine that they would be like, but also a cruel version of themselves, which is actually quite brave. You know, there's a couple of performances you think, wow, because people will look at this and think, that is what you're like.
And exactly, examining themselves, you know, putting a microscope up, putting themselves under a microscope, and really kind of eviscerating themselves, I think they do, which is very brave. And that's why, that's partly why I'm really taking with it.
What's the movie in which you've played something that's actually closest to you?
It's a really good question, because I do tend to play parts which are a lot further away from me, I suppose. I did a film many, many years ago called The Jolly Boy's Last Stand, which no one will probably have ever heard of. But it was actually one of the earliest films that kind of used digital photography, digital cameras. And it was like a documentary. It was sort of office style kind of storytelling, I suppose. People were aware of the camera. It was, you know, that kind of thing. And I suppose I was playing a character that was not far away from myself. I wasn't having to do anything particularly to travel towards the character to transform, or, you know, it was very much me, I suppose.
Is that easier or more difficult than playing a character that is completely different to you? Because I remember asking you once when we were talking about your portrayal of Ian Dury, who you had really got inside the skin of, but you said, you know, I was saying, are there similarities? You said, no, we are such different characters that one of the things that you had found, the way that you were going to character was because you were so different as people.
I think that's right. I mean, it is, you know, it's always a process of, you know, when you're approaching a role or you're thinking of taking a role on, it's just like, where does the Venn diagram cross over between you and your experience? I mean, you're always using your own experience. You're always using your, you know, ultimately it's your perception, your take on how, you know, where do I meet this character, you know, where is the common ground, what's the, you know, what where do we cross over, and usually my Venn diagrams are sort of very sort of, if you can see, sort of they're tiny little meeting points, really, I suppose, but you have to have them, whatever character you're playing, even a character like Ian Brady, you know, what is, and I'm jumping Ian's for a second, because that was, you know, I would like to think I'm nowhere near what Ian Brady's like, but you have to think, how can I get inside the head of someone who could do what he did? And I found it's, you know, you use means of, you know, they validated, he and Myra Hindley, for instance, validated their lives by and Myra Hindley said of Ian Brady, for instance, that she found it the most beautiful thing in the world, standing on the moors with him at night under the moon, having committed the acts that they'd done. And I had to think, well, what validates my life? What is the most extraordinary thing that makes me feel alive? You know, and that was witnessing the birth of my children. So while I'm playing Ian Brady, I'm thinking about, you know, seeing my children being born at home in, you know, they were all born in our house. So it was like, it's, you transpose, it's all about, transposing, I suppose. But I do find on the whole, to answer your question, characters that are further away, I feel more comfortable. Mm-hmm. I feel more comfortable taking bigger journeys, I suppose. I mean, I look at an actor like someone like Isabelle Huppert, and I just marvel at someone who can be so totally emotionally truthful, seemingly like exactly how that, if you met them on the street, they would be exactly like that. You know, she does, whatever role she plays, she seems to make it feel like she is that person. I know that sounds absurd, but do you know what I mean? It's sort of, she's extraordinary. And I look at her and go, I could never do that in a million years. You know, that's just not me. I have to crawl around, jump around and do things, you know.
It is amazing. I mean, the Isabelle Huppert thing is astonishing, because when you look at the breadth of her career, I mean, you know, I always forget she's in Heaven's Gate. I mean, amidst everything else, she's, you know, she's kind of the female lead in Heaven's Gate. No, and just an extraordinary career. Also, it's worth saying that, you know, of your portrayal of Ian Brady, obviously Samantha Morton is such a big part of that, you know, that combination. And she's been a guest on the show before, and I think she's one of the finest actors working today. And I'm sure it must have been a real pleasure to work with her.
Well, weirdly, I mean, I know Samantha very well. I've worked with her many times, but weirdly on that particular film, we didn't get to work together at all because we were separated. We were in different cells, you know, in different prisons at different points in history. So our paths never actually crossed, weirdly. But no, I agree. I mean, she's a phenomenon. She really is. She's a terrific actress. Just, you know, so present, so totally real, and you know, just connected to the moment. I mean, really extraordinary.
So the other thing I wanted to ask you was the film that changed your life. And this is a film that's important to you, a film that has a particular meaning to you. What did you choose?
I actually chose Apocalypse Now, actually. Perhaps not very original. I'm sure you've had lots of people who have said this to you before. Countless people, in fact. But that is the fact. That is true. I remember seeing it when I was about 15 years old. I saw it in 70mm, and it just blew my head off, really. I saw it very early on when it came out, and I'd been really tempted by the incredible posters, and, you know, just like really drawn to the visuals of that, and the graphic of the poster, actually, the typography, you know. And when I went to see it, it was just, I've never been so transported by a movie ever in my life, and just went on the journey. And it's, again, it's one that I return to constantly because it's such a powerful, you know, the levels it works on, the metaphors it uses, the story it's telling at its base level, the performances, just everything about it, I just found kind of intoxicating, and you know, made me really take notice of how powerful film can be.
This is the end, beautiful friend. This is the end, my only friend. The end of our elaborate plans. The end of everything that stands. The end.
Do you have a preferred version of it? Because you know, Andy, that it exists in several versions.
I literally have just, I went to the Lake Como Film Festival last year, which is great, really amazing. And I watched the latest cut, Francis Ford Coppola's, you know, directed cut, from 2 o'clock in the morning till 5 o'clock in the morning. And it was literally, I've never seen it on a big screen since. I saw it when I was 15.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. And it was just, you know, it was just, yeah, extraordinary. Yeah.
Do you think that there is, I remember seeing Apocalypse Now. I think I must have seen it in the West End, because I saw it. It's the first time I really remember not just stereo sound, but the beginning, the helicopters, like you could hear them apparently circling around. I don't know how much of that I imagined because I was young, but I have a really profound memory of that opening.
Yeah,
being like immersive cinema like I hadn't experienced before. Did you have a similar experience?
Totally. I mean, literally, it was absolutely as you're describing. Felt like it was, where is this coming from? I mean, the only other experience I had kind of watching when I was about 18 years old, this sounds quite weird, but I actually worked on security for the Pink Floyd The Wall concert.
Wow.
And I tore tickets. I actually tore tickets for Stevie Wonder. I tore Stevie Wonder's ticket.
Wow. Thrilled.
But it's a, yeah, and I saw that show 10 nights in a row, and it was And it had that experience. It was, you know, again, it was obviously the sound felt, because it was coming from everywhere. But the madness of that show just sort of surrounded me. It was reminiscent of that experience of watching Apocalypse Now.
Roger, here we go. Good. Give it all you got. Bring in all your ships. Wing of breath.
Don't worry. We'll have this place cleaned up and ready for us in a jiffy, son. Don't you worry.
Big up 6, this is Sub-13. The jet stream by now. There, you've got about 30 seconds on station. Get your people back and head down. This is going to be a big one.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
You know, all, I mean, all the stuff that you're doing now with the Imaginarium and with, you know, pushing forward the boundaries of how films are made in terms of, you know, performance capture and everything that's changed. It all comes down to storytelling and the experience of the story. And do you see a line, like an artistic through line between what Coppola was doing, you know, with Apocalypse Now? You know, we all famously know the stories of him going crazy whilst making it and dedicating, you know, all this time. And the famous phrase that he used, you know, we were in the jungle, we had too much time, too much money, too much equipment, and one by one, we all went insane. But you know, you've always talked about the technological advancements as just being another way of immersing the audience in that story. So do you think that there is a continuum between what Coppola was doing with Apocalypse Now and what you're now doing with movies that have, you know, that are very technologically grounded in their creation?
I mean, I think you're right in that it's all about story. So at the end of the day, whether it's, you know, reading it out loud for making it come alive for someone, or whether it's, you know, you're making Avatar 5, it's all about story and character. So however, I mean, I've always been fascinated with kind of the future of next generation storytelling, and I think we're at such an interesting moment in time where, you know, you have streamers, you've got cinema, you've got virtual production, so that when you're making a movie, you can basically do pre-visualization in a video game engine and see what the shots are going to look like, and you can do virtual scouting and all of these kind of things. But I come from a theatre background, you know, originally, and that's never left me as a notion that, and I suppose what I'm saying is, Where I think we could be heading is a version of all of these things coming together, and that's what excites me. And when I say all of these things, I think, you know, things like, you know, virtual reality and augmented reality and a theatre and secret cinema, and, you know, theatre companies like Punch Drunk, who do experiential theatre, where promenade theatre, where you're walking in and out of, you're led, not necessarily narratively, but you're led into different areas and experience their plays. You experience not necessarily even in chronologically, how, you know, or if there is such a thing as chronologically with their work. But point being, I do think we are, you know, people want to have, and when we can all socially gather together to watch these things, which of course we can't at the moment, but, you know, when it is possible again, there is this growing, I don't know, there's this event hunger that I think continues, and there is a way of bringing performance capture into live theatre, into, you know, using, you know, cinema at the same time. And I don't know, we've been trying to do different things like that, like we worked with the Royal Shakespeare Company on The Tempest, and we had an action and performance catcher suit playing Ariel, and then we were able to project the avatar images of him around on various different surfaces and smoke and on tree bark and all this kind of stuff, you know, and then at the same time, I worked on a project where we captured an entire theatre production using AR and with an idea of bottling a performance, so that maybe in 10 years' time, you've actually got those performances. They came into our studio and we recorded the whole thing. You know, then in 10 or 20 years' time, you might want to reinvent. You have, you know, the thing about theatre, of course, is once it's gone, it's gone. But here you have the base performances, which are captured in a bottle, if you like. But then you can reinterpret those great performances that have been worked on and kind of honed in rehearsal. And, you know, unlike filming, where you're jumping in and, you know, actors have had weeks to rehearse and have honed performances in a run of a play. But to take that then and then, in 20 years' time, say, redesign it and make it more accessible to an audience who are living in a different era, to have the essence of those performances underlying. And we created a piece which shrunk the actors down so that you can, their tabletop height as a piece of tabletop theatre, and that you can walk all the way around and have a look at. And, you know, so there's those sorts of things, you know. You know, I remember going back to Francis Ford Coppola, you know, him saying one day we'll all be able to make films, basically, that one day an 8-year-old with a video camera will be able to tell her, you know, her story, or, you know, his story. So I think he was always very, I mean, you know, with Zoetrope, when he was trying to, you know, use the moving, you know, to the TV style cameras, when he was making One from the Heart, which I love, that film is one of them.
Yeah.
Another one of my favourite films, actually.
No, that's a beauty, and such a great soundtrack. Just
incredible. Tom Waits and Crystal Gale. Just amazing. Sorry, I've just rambled hugely.
No, but do you think that we are going to be back in that communal space anytime soon? I mean, the thing that I genuinely don't know the answer to this. And everyone keeps saying, what do you think? Cinemas are going to open. You know, we hear that they're talking about Tenet as a July opening. Bond is still, you know, up for November. You're talking about movies being moved back to June of next year. Do you think that, what do you think is going to happen to the theatrical experience? Do you have any sense of how soon we are going to be back in cinemas?
I mean, I just keep hearing lots of different things, really, you know, that sort of the fall, you know, autumn time, you know, things will start to ease up. And then people saying, well, no, because, you know, God forbid there's a second wave and that maybe that might not. But, you know, so it's very, very, no one knows. It's impossible. It's impossible to know at the moment. You know, in terms of production, I think people are sort of thinking again, September, October, that films are going to start going back into production. This is just this is hearsay. You know, it's just what I'm gathering, you know, as I talk to people, but I think the idea of quite frankly, the idea of people sitting next to someone else at the moment is too terrifying, and is, you know, I think it's gonna be a while before we feel comfortable doing that, I think.
And even in terms of production, will production have to resume with social distancing? I mean, we were talking to George Mackay, the actor, just the other day, and he was saying, well, you know, people are already talking about ways of maybe putting a set together with people keeping distance. Is that a practicality?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, the conventional filming, I think, has its problems because film crews are large. And having said that, what is interesting is that the motion capture world absolutely lends itself to socially distanced performing. Yeah. Because you can actually work remotely with another actor. You can actually do it. You know, we could play a scene together with me on the motion capture stage, with you at home, you know, and playing opposite me. As long as I'm looking into your eyes, I can play a scene with you. So we, you know, in actual fact, what's very interesting is that performance capture and animation at the moment are, I think, going to be able to move ahead a lot quicker, because you also don't need huge crews if you're shooting it entirely CG. This is entirely CG now I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Not shooting performance capture on a live action set like on the Apes movies, where obviously that's a film crew plus a motion capture. I'm talking about purely performance capture driven in a motion capture volume. That is very, very doable. And so I think there's some movement around, you know, creating content using you know, either straight up animation, where you can, you know, you can create storyboards and develop the story and do that, because everyone works sort of in isolation anyway in that respect from the visual effects world. So I think certainly that, I think, has huge potential right now. You know, adult animation as well as family-oriented animation. I think there's definitely possibilities there. Film, you know, conventional filming. I mean, I've heard talk again of, you know, crews, you know, having two crews and switching them up and cleaning the gear and all of that kind of stuff. I mean, I don't know about socially distancing while you're actually playing a scene. I don't know how that works. I suppose you can cheat. You can cheat close-ups so that they're not, you know, you're not necessarily very close to that person, and you have distance. Again, once you're looking into the eyes of another actor, those things are achievable.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine that the only way you could do it is actually to completely isolate a cast together for the period for the period of time. But I mean, when I start talking about it, I feel like I'm talking like a J.G. Ballard novel or like a science fiction novel. It's like we are now living in such a strange reality. Yeah. That perhaps it will take something like the incredible science of performance capture and what's now being, you know, to actually bring us all back together again, which is a very interesting prospect.
Well, it's certainly, again, it's story and character, but and you know that, and also because it's become you know, usable for streamers, for TV, which is of course how we're all watching at the moment.
Yeah,
to go to cinema, it does lend, and the combination of that and in game engine real-time rendering, which means you can keep the costs down. It means that you can design, you know, I can come up with an idea, design, you know, have characters designed working with someone remotely. I can go into the motion capture studio and work with a handful of people, get that character up and running. Environments can be designed. It's very doable. It's very doable at the moment. So I think there might well be a sort of, it could be quite potentially useful for this moment in time.
I have a suspicion that in the future, to bring this to an end, I have a suspicion that in the future people will look back on your career particularly, and in the transition that you've made from theatre into the very cutting edge of where we now are with technological advancement, and see it as a pivotal moment in the evolution of the art form. I honestly think, Andy, that what you're doing is really artistically crucial to what's happening to cinema. And I'm going to close by asking you whether you have any sense of that at all. Do you ever feel like we are on the cusp of something that is literally world changing in terms of the movement of the artistic process?
Well, I think every generation feels they are, and because we are, you know, you go back to early cinema and sound cinema coming in. I was looking yesterday at the jazz singer, and there was an article about the progression of how sound was used, and we happened to be watching Mutiny on the Bounty with Charles Laughton last night with the kids' grandparents who are now here with us, and you know, every generation, well, things do progress. But I do think, going back to the Francis Ford Coppola thing, you know, that there has been an explosion in the last 20 years, with one of course the internet, which is a huge part of it, and video game engine technology, which was looked down on as a very lower art form. You know, it's become completely central to making films now. Big films, not to small independent films, but certainly the big movies. So I do think, I just feel very lucky to have sort of landed at a moment where, originally from an acting perspective, where suddenly this tool arrived which enabled you to play anything, and that has been so exciting, and completely a banana curve in my career. I didn't intend to. I really thought I was just going to go back to conventional acting after The Lord of the Rings. I never thought it was, I never thought anything else was going to be possible. But then you just see all of the strands of all of these tools that are available, and then you look at what people can achieve at home. Working remotely, but creating movies on iPhones and creating music the availability to express oneself now is just, it's just exponentially massive compared to when we were growing up, and we tried to put together mixtapes and tried to get a Super 8, and it's a different world.
Yeah. Well, listen, I wish you all the very best. I can't wait for what we're going through now to be at an end, and so everybody can sort of see each other again and shake hands again. Yeah. But until then, stay well, stay safe. I think you're a real inspiration, Andy, and carry on fighting the good fight.
It's lovely to see you, and hopefully we'll get to play together sometime.
yeah, exactly. You have to come on the show and actually play the music. All right, take care.
All right, look after yourself. Take care. Yeah. Great to see you.
The great Andy Serkis talking to me for the most recent MK3D online show. As you probably know, that show usually takes place at the BFI South Bank, but obviously at the moment the BFI South Bank is closed, so we've moved it online for the moment. It'll probably stay online for a few months more. Do go and check out the show. It's got Monica Dolan, Simon Bird, Jason Isaacs and Andy Serkis. It's on the BFI's YouTube channel. If you've enjoyed listening to that interview as well, then why not go to the Kermode on Film Patreon page? There's a load of extras there, extra video, extra audio, lots and lots of exclusive content. Please do check it out. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. Tell your friends. Remember to subscribe and keep watching the skies.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.